You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul Bloom.
Hello, Robert Wright. How are you doing?
I just couldn't be better, gosh darn it. Let me tell people who we are. You're Paul Bloom, famous psychologist, proprietor of the Small Potatoes newsletter, prolific reader. You've read all those books behind you, right, Paul?
Everyone, many times. I just reach behind the shelf and scoop them up sometimes.
That's
just
an inside joke, folks, because that's a fake background.
Yeah.
Sorry, was I revealing too much there, Paul?
You once complimented me on how nice my office was, and I shut it off, and you were just
shocked.
First
time I saw it, I believed it. Yeah. That's how gullible I am.
It's meant to be fairly convincing.
If it's the Toronto winter,
the greenery behind will give it away. You are Robert Wright?
I'm Robert Wright.
Author of the Non-Zero newsletter?
Yes, and the book Non-Zero, for that matter. And this is kind of the Non-Zero podcast. Although they can also find it at the Small Potatoes newsletter, including the special bonus section available to
paid subscribers.
Yeah.
Taters.
We call them members, I think.
Members.
But we're not there yet. We're in the public part of the podcast, available to all. What's up in this crazy, zany simulation of ours, Paul?
So yeah, I feel we have too many of our discussions have the headline, Elon Musk does this, or we analyze Elon Musk. Yet nonetheless, he is so interesting.
He's doing stuff.
Next to Donald Trump, who a character he has allied himself with, he just generates news all the time.
It's funny. I was listening to he was at the All In conference put on by the All In podcast, and they started off talking about how it feels like we're living in a simulation, which is funny because he's the main reason. Of all the reasons that it feels to me like we're living in a simulation, he is one of the main ones. I mean, this is getting crazy. So he's gone. I mean, we knew he was supporting Trump. We knew he was giving tons of money, but now he's like touring with Trump. He showed up with Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania, site of the would-be assassination.
Finishing off the speech, yes.
And, said stuff. You want to hear one thing he said?
I certainly do.
I hope the magic of technology makes this happen. We'll see. Here we go. This is Elon Musk talking with Donald Trump standing next to him on stage at a Trump rally. Oh, I guess you have to.
This is no ordinary election. The other side wants to take away your freedom of speech. They want to take away your right to bear arms. That they want to, they want to take away your right to vote effectively. This is a must win situation.
Must win. Register to vote.
Now, Paul, I think he's exaggerating.
They only want to take away a few of those rights. Definitely free speech, definitely guns, maybe not the voting part. You'll be allowed to vote.
You will be allowed to vote.
But votes will be swamped by all of the illegal immigrant votes that will then always vote Democrat.
I find this genuinely alarming to have. You've already got a situation where if you're a billionaire, you can single-handedly swing an election. Supposedly he's gonna do $180 million for Trump's super PAC. And now he's got himself a huge following of fanboys who probably a fair number are either undecided about the election, don't care that much, or kind of Trump leaning, but weren't sure they'd have the energy to vote. I mean, he could make a big difference, and he's a flat out demagogue. I mean, they're going to take away your guns. Could he really have such a dim understanding of American politics to know that there's not even a prayer of like limiting the size of magazines to 30 bullets so that you can only kill 30 kids at a school? I mean, that is not a remote, that right there is not a remotely possible thing in American politics, okay?
There is some exaggeration by both Musk and Trump. Musk, you didn't have the clip where he says, I'm not just MAGA, I'm dark MAGA.
He started off that way. The crowd didn't totally get the joke. I guess it was a reference to Dark Brandon or something.
something.
Yeah. Maybe there already is a dark MAGA meme. He was wearing a dark hat. You know, he has a sense of humor, disturbingly, which showed up every once in a while. I think he could make an impact.
He could.
The polls, I noticed, I hadn't looked at them in a couple of days. I don't mean the polls, I mean the betting markets are now looking pretty good for Trump. Like, he's got like a 5-6 point lead in the betting markets, which was the best since the debate with Kamala. And I wonder if I don't think the polls have moved all that much. And I wondered if it was
haven't moved. The polls have been kind of constant.
Yeah.
I was started reading an analysis by Nate Silver as to why the prediction markets had shifted while the polls have not.
But what did he say?
Unfortunately, it was for paid subscribers. I only got to the part where he says, so the answer is, so I'll go back.
That guy knows how to generate the revenue. See, that's what you and I need to do is more get them on the edge of their seat lines right before the paywall. We should have one in this podcast. We should think of
one. We should mid-sentence. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I heard Musk talking to Tucker Carlson, where Musk first went on, this is somewhat in bad taste, that nobody would ever want to assassinate Kamala or Biden, because who cares? They're just puppets of the deep state. They'll just replace them with somebody else. But then he said that if she gets elected...
Can I just say that is kind of in bad taste? I mean, but
yeah, no, ahead. I think the Musk assassination riffs are not as funny as he thinks they are. He also predicted that he would himself end up in prison if she got elected.
No, I think he believes that. I think he has tweeted that, and I mean, I don't know if he believes it. That's the thing. There's, you know, it's surprising how many billionaires sound like paranoids these days, and he's one of them.
Deeply paranoid. Do you think it's sincere? Do you think it's just more demagoguery?
I think there's a real strain of paranoia in him, and in some of these, and some of these other billionaires. You know, there was the famous book, "Only the Paranoid Survive," by the guy Andy Grove, who was the head of Intel during its golden years. And I think probably a lot of people who do very well in business stay up all night wondering which competitor is after them. They like have this tendency to like be hyper vigilant, and like that's kind of a one step toward paranoia.
I mean, Musk is interesting in so many ways. One of the ways in which he's interesting is that he contradicts the notion of these billionaires as rational maximizers. Mm-hmm. He has lost so much money on Twitter. He loses so many advertisers. He loses so many supporters with his support of Trump. He has put himself in a situation. He's a guy who likes high risk, that if Trump wins, he's in a very nice situation. If Trump loses, he's probably in a very bad situation. I don't think Harris is going to put him in prison, but he's purposely antagonizing the party that, you know, has 50% chance of winning. It's different from the sort of cold-blooded CEOs who donate 50% of their money to Republicans, 50% right. Democrats, suck up to everybody and try to please everybody. And that is not Musk's style.
And kind of don't say anything in public that you know, gives away any strong political preference. That's the way it was done in olden times. Now, I mean, you know, maximizing expected value, expected return, is one approach to life, famously championed by Sam Bankman-Fried, who's now in prison for having tried to maximize expected return and failed. But, you know, in other words, they just figure out risk doesn't matter. Whatever, you know, you just multiply the probability of winning big times the amount you'd win, and you go with the higher number. And Musk, look, if Trump wins, he's king of the world. You know,
he may be running large sections of the government.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, he may be some kind of czar. I mean, some kind of, you know, his big thing is business efficiency. He was talking on this All In podcast about how much he would cut government, you know, waste, and the idea was very explicitly that like this would be his portfolio, like Trump would just let him go around slashing departmental budgets or whatever. But plus, you know, he'll just he'll be palling around with the president. And of course, I mean, Trump is exactly the kind of guy who would reward this kind of support with twice the number of government contracts Musk, you know, like SpaceX already has. So, you know, he stands to gain a lot. I right now would guess Trump will win.
Really? Why more than a coin toss?
Because the world seems to be falling apart, and that's bad for incumbents when everything seems to be spinning out of control. Middle East, in particular. You know, Trump tried to take advantage of these floods, and I don't know how well he succeeded, but North Carolina is a very important state.
Yeah.
I don't know. And, you know, Kamala Harris, I don't think, I was hoping there would be somebody else would replace Biden. I don't think she's that great a campaigner. I don't think Tim Walz is that. We haven't talked since the debate, but the vice president debate, which I don't think either of us. I watched the first 10 minutes and couldn't bear it any longer. I don't think you saw it. So
I was out with a friend. You see, this is why, by the way, just to shift things, get a bit meta, why you're more of an intellectual than sort of a pundit type. No pundit would miss the debate. It would be debating all the discussions. You're looking at the higher things. You could afford to miss a VP debate.
How do you know I didn't switch to a football game?
But that's okay. That's okay. I don't care if you do something you enjoy, but. A true pundit would really be focused on it, give the sort of details of this comeback and that comeback, the moment it changed and all that stuff. You're looking at the, it speaks well of you that you didn't see the debate.
Yeah, what I actually did was went off and thought about the mind body problem instead.
Exactly.
So you're right.
Issues involving sentience, determinism, the big span of history. Like where will we be 50,000 years from now?
Why did the Roman Empire collapse after all?
Those are the questions that occupy you.
These are the questions that keep me up at night.
But no, I saw clips of it. Everybody says, in some way, apparently Vance, both of the candidates became more popular among the people who watched the debate. Mm-hmm. Since Vance may have been a bit of trouble for Trump, he was so unpopular. This might be a good thing on balance for Republicans.
I think so. I mean, supposedly, Waltz's approval rating, or whatever the technical name for it is, his favorables went up more than Vance's. But I still agree with you that Vance's unfavorables were more politically problematic than Waltz's.
I mean, in some way, he may have been heading to be a Sarah Palin type character, which is people might vote against the party because he's there. No longer. I think people, you know, I think. He's no dummy.
Oh, he's definitely not a dummy. That was never the problem. It was that he had said so many weird things like, like people who have children should get more votes in American elections. That's kind of a strange thing to say, you know?
It is. Childless cat lady, he thinks. But he was, he apparently didn't appear so strange. Waltz appeared awkward.
Yeah. Waltz is, I've said it all along, he's disappointingly inarticulate.
A lot of people like his shtick. It doesn't.
No, I like the vibe. I like the vibe, Coach Waltz.
The vibe doesn't do so well for me. The thing about Waltz's vibe is he's doing his thing, you know, his football coach, but a thing. But he seems to be enjoying. He seems to be too conscious of it. He seems to be too pleased with himself.
Yeah.
And I kind of a little bit smarmy. I don't know.
Yeah, like when he says, "Well, where I come from, nobody went to Yale."
That bothered me.
And that lost your vote because you for a long time taught at Yale, right? Is that why you moved to Canada when he said that and you were afraid he might occupy the White House?
Neither party makes me happy anymore. I feel there's an anti Ivy League bias on both parties. That's really bad for America.
Yep. The shit is so weird, man. I don't know what to hope for.
I mean, going back to him, he's such an interesting character. He is, the amount of good he does is substantial. the bringing, making electric vehicles, Tesla and everything is really good. His space exploration stuff, he's on track to rescue these astronauts and everything. Starlink apparently has helped many people in need. Those are substantial accomplishments, but he seems to also be a narcissistic, deeply troubled character who has aligned himself with totalitarian forces and honestly ruined a social media platform that I kind of enjoyed.
Yeah. And, but he genuinely believes that it's the opposite, that democracy is doomed. I mean, yeah. He says in this very riff, I don't think we got to it, did we? Where he says, if Trump loses, this will be the last election.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know. I think he at least 50% believes that. For my money, are somewhat exaggerating the peril to democracy. Although I got to say, after January 6th and the election denialism, I'm more concerned about Trump than I was. But they both genuinely believe, both sides, I guess, genuinely believe that the other side is out to extinguish democracy.
Yeah. And I wouldn't I like to see an American election where people don't say this is the most important election in human history.
Yeah. They don't say that in Canada? Do they not say that?
We barely have elections. You know, you have to call an election.
Yeah.
At some point, you just call it and then people run out and have it. The prediction markets that have the Conservative Party beating the Liberals at like 99.99%. It is not so much going to be, it's not going to win every seat, but there's no chance Liberals winning.
So Trudeau, when is the election?
It has not been called. The prime minister gets to call it within a certain period.
I wouldn't call it either if I were a liberal and the markets were saying 99.
You're not allowed to wait forever. I think they have to get it by the end of next year or something. They have to call it. And then there's a fairly short election cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, you and I are going to talk Canadian politics a lot. I don't want
to. I'm really looking forward to that, Paul, but I'm afraid I have other plans that day. there's been something that's just been forever. I've been committed to from way back on whatever day this turns out to be.
You know what they say? Canadian politics is a way to get the viewers, get the clicks.
You know what?
I know. This is your line, right?
Go ahead. Kinsley, he wrote a whole column about the most boring headline in the history.
Go on.
Oh, you don't know? It was
remind me.
It was Worthwhile Canadian Initiative. It was actually written by Mort Kondracki, who was also at the New Republic, although I think he wrote it for somebody. I don't think it was in our magazine, but and it was about NAFTA before NAFTA was NAFTA. It started out as a trade negotiations with just Canada, I think. And Mort wrote a piece called Worthwhile Canadian Initiative and Mike just saw it and thought, I cannot imagine a piece I would less rather read than that. And so wrote a whole thing about it.
Yeah, the Canadian.
But no, I don't mean that offensively, Paul. I hope that didn't.
There are worse things than being boring. It's not a good trait, but there are worse things than being a boring
country. I'd settle for boring. I mean, if America just became super boring right now, that would be such a huge improvement. So you guys need to give us the secret of your success. How do you stay so boring?
I wonder, it's not the multi-party system, because a lot of interesting countries have multiple parties that clash in interesting ways and odd coalitions. Maybe, here's a segue. Donald Trump was talking about the genes, the genetic properties of some people who are, he says, invading our country. Maybe genetically, the Canadians.
You think you have boring genes?
Boring's a harsh word. We have staple genes, high conscientiousness, respect for others.
Genes.
That's it. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So Donald Trump, I'm not sure I have the quote, but he basically said, I'll get it. I'll call up this article. But he was basically, of course, talking about immigration. And he said, the quote is, we have got a lot of bad genes in our country right now. And the preface to that was, claiming that 13,000. Okay, how about allowing people to come to an open border? 13,000 of which were murders. Many of them murdered far more than one person. Now, first of all, you know what I'll bet, Paul? I don't know where he gets the 13,000 number. It's probably the number of Americans killed by legal and illegal immigrants over the last number of years. But wherever the number comes from, I'll bet it's the number of murders, right, that are committed by them. So when he says 13,000 of which were murderers, and that many of them murdered far more than one person, I'll bet there's an internal contradiction right there if you look at the stats. But I digress. That's not that.
This could blow the election wide
this
open.
This could blow the election wide open, because if there's one thing American voters will not put up with, it's a logical contradiction.
Somebody once suggested that Trump has this riff about people escaping asylums to go into the United States. Mm-hmm. And the claim that they make is that Trump is confused about the notion of sort of seeking asylum, and they kind of parse it as they are escaping from insane asylums.
That would definitely
another contradiction that would sink him if it turned out to be true.
That would definitely not shock me.
Yes, so, he was talking about the bad genes of these
people.
Yeah,
he says, wait, there's another part. Now a murderer, he says, I believe this. It's in their genes. He's saying murderers all have murderer genes. And we got a lot of bad genes in our country right now. So that's the logic, is that some number of immigrants have killed people, that killing people is in the genes. So we've got bad genes coming into the country.
Yeah.
Yeah. His father was an immigrant. I'm not sure about those genes. But what do you have to say about that, Paul, about genes? Yeah, by the way, we can talk about this in overtime, but I'm so out of it that I only just realized that John Tooby died last year, which you surely knew.
Yes.
Great.
Yes.
Well, as much as anyone else laid the foundations of evolutionary psychology. And the reason I think of this is because when I was these many years ago promoting my book on evolutionary psychology, and I was on TV and he saw me and he was so gratified that I answered the question, what is evolutionary psychology, this way. I said, first of all, let me tell you what it's not. It's not the study of how different people having different genes leads different people to behave differently. That's behavioral genetics. Evolutionary psychology is more about the study of human nature generally, the things people everywhere have in common. Anyway, that was he stressed that part of Ev Psych.
He did. And one of the things about Ev Psych is it's very much focused on human universals. Some of his critics, I think, often maliciously and unfairly say, oh, it's this racist idea that different groups have different genes that make them, some of them bad, some of them good. But the idea is to focus on what we all have in common. And along with his wife, Lita Cosmides, John did some wonderful, brilliant work establishing the framework for this theory. So he was really a sad loss to the field. And he was also a mensch, really good guy.
Really good guy. He's at UC Santa Barbara, where Lita still is.
Yep.
And they also lost Don Brown, who wrote a book called Universals, a little book about like things that are common to cultures everywhere, things you'll find in every society.
It has a list, it's very entertaining.
So anyway, where were we? I'm sure there is some correlation between genes and aggression. I mean, for example, if you have male genes, for starters,
there's certainly some correlation, you know. Because, like you say, the genes, the male-female difference in violence is certainly due, at least in a large part, to genes and to actually.
With male and female, there's some pretty clear-cut cases. That's like the one exception to how I answered that question.
That's right. Because natural selection doesn't have, there's no straightforward evolutionary argument for why Mexicans should be different from Canadians. But there is an evolutionary argument for why old people should be different from young people, and why men should be different from women. And in fact, men are physically larger than women. And it's expressed that these differences express themselves in the bodies, have to do with sexual selection and so on, very Darwinian reasons. Mm-hmm. But the sex difference and age differences too are the sort of cases where you would find differences. Evolutionary psychologists tend to be a lot less interested in whatever genetic differences there are between groups. And there have to be some people from different parts of the world look different. So we know there's some.
And I mean, one thing people don't appreciate, and this gets back to the question of violence and the genes, is EVSITE can provide explanations for why different environments lead to different outcomes. You know, Martin Daly and Margot Wilson, two great evolutionary psychologists, wrote a book called Homicide, where they argued, among other things, that if you look at, I mean, when you find like ostensible correlations, well, they are correlations between ethnic groups and violence. When you correct for things like income level, they tend to go away. It's a really smart book. But anyway, one thing I would say is that I certainly wouldn't surprise me if illegal immigrants have a higher rate of crime and homicide. Both of those things do correlate with income level, and they are mostly the low income level. Some of them are, are kind of have to live in the shadows and so on. But I don't know what the numbers are, actually. I haven't even looked at how close Trump's even numbers are to.
I mean, Trump talks a lot about genes at every level. He talks mm-hmm. about his own genetic propensity towards genius. I think he had an uncle who taught at MIT or something, and he talks about himself being a genius. I think at some point he was addressing groups of Jews, and he talked, in a complimentary way about our natural propensity to be good with money.
Yeah.
And it's, I think regard to immigrants, a lot of this talk is malicious and meant to be nasty and to mm-hmm. foster prejudice. But in general, there's just a worldview that these racial differences are profound and deep and genetic.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't say, I guess, that in the case of Jews, this was because of the genes, did he? Or I wouldn't put it past him.
I'd have to look it up. I remember at some point he had I know he's complimented to Jewish groups complimented our abilities with finance. I'm not mm-hmm. sure. I'm not sure if he made a point that that's genetic.
He's also said that I forget how he put it, but it was close. It was kind of reminding me of the time Biden said to the black guy, "You're not black if you're not voting for me." You remember that?
Oh, did he?
You ain't black. It was like he was being interviewed, and the guy said he might vote for Trump or something like that, I think, if I'm recalling correctly. Biden said, "You ain't black." Anyway, Trump has said the same thing about Jews, that they're not good Jews if they don't vote for him. And, what he's doing is conflating Jewish identity with Israeli citizenship or something. Because what he means is he thinks he's better for Israel than Biden.
Yep. Yep.
So anyway, well, what Israel brings us to, Paul?
It brings us to an interview on the CBS Morning Show.
Yeah, one of the CBS Morning News. Things.
It's by Coates, Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Ta-Nehisi
Coates.
He's got a new book out called The Message. He was a guest.
Yeah.
And this CBS interviewer came at him pretty hard. It turns out they know each other, which I think may account for why Ta-Nehisi handled it with, I thought, more calm than I might have mustered if somebody started off saying, basically, your book is the book of an extremist.
Yeah. So I saw the clip. It's actually entertaining. It's interesting. I thought Coates came off very well. He argued back. I'm sort of thinking that all of these interviews should be like this. It's much more interesting when somebody comes out with a book, particularly a controversial book, for people to say, "Oh yeah, I think you got important things wrong. You're very biased." And then let the person respond.
But he didn't say he got anything wrong. So we should tell people. So
okay.
Coates' book is called The Message. And this guy focused on the part about, the book has, I think, three parts. He went to Africa. It's a reflection on groups and their ethnic and national narratives and stuff, and his own ancestry as an African-American and so on. He went to Africa, he went to someplace in America, and then he went to the West Bank. And his, account of the West Bank is not, what your average pro-Israel, advocate would like to see out there. I mean, he calls it an apartheid state and on and on and on. And that's the part this guy focused on. Turns out this guy has to children who live in Israel, lived in Israel on October 7th of last year. And he started off by saying, you know, look, if I didn't see the cover of this book and he wrote it, I'd say this was written by an extremist. Let me see if I can find any other quotes. It's like something like you're trying to undermine the pillars of Israel or something. You delegitimizes the pillars of Israel and also doesn't talk about the many, doesn't tell Israel's side of the historical story as to how they came to be in this position with respect to Palestine.
And I haven't read the book, but Coates conceded that point. Coates said, I'm not telling that story. That story's been told so many other places. I'm telling a different story. I'm focusing on Israel's crimes. I'm focusing from the perspective of the victims. The story, Coates says, their story has not been adequately told. And it's a fair answer. I mean, I thought it was just an interesting back and forth. I was sort of surprised that, to continue what happened, a lot of people were very upset about this. I don't know whether the person asking the questions was sanctioned in some way, punished.
Well, what we know, apparently there was some blowback from within the CBS news staff. Because an official had a Zoom conference with a bunch of the staff mentioning the Coates interview, not mentioning the interviewer by name, but saying, conveying, it was all pretty vague. I mean, she didn't want to be all that explicit, but kind of conveying that they had probably had a word with the interviewer. Not that he's being officially, that there was any official penalty or anything, but that they were not happy about the interview. I mean, you got the sense. And then this ran in the free press, which, of course, is very anti-woke and very anti-trigger sensitivity. You definitely did get the sense. I listened to some of the leaked audio from the Zoom meeting, which was given to the free press. And it was clear that, you know, some probably younger staffers complained. I mean, they could have been of Arab ancestry. They could have been Blacks who felt that, you know, Coates hadn't been treated fairly because of his color. They could have been young Jewish leftists. Who knows? But there had been blowback. And the free press kind of got, I think, outraged about that because they're the free press. I mean, both, they're both anti-woke and they're very pro-Israel. My take is, you know, the question of the kind of journalistic propriety of it stands independent of who first complained about it. I mean, it definitely was this CBS official. You know, it was a very kind of woke era kind of thing where she's clearly concerned about the sensibilities of these young people who complain.
And now, and I sent you this, but now they're having somebody come to talk to the CBS staff, the people there, who is an expert in DEI issues and trauma.
Right.
To deal with. If you hear some scorn in my voice, you are hearing it correctly.
Paul is very anti-woke. Paul spends most of his days crushing young woke people. Is that right?
I own the libs. I don't know. Yes.
You own the woke.
No, I forget the phrasing these days. It's not so much I'm anti-woke. I'm very pro. I'm pro in general, pro free speech, but I'm also pro people arguing different views. I mean, you know, Coates comes in with a very, very strong claim. I imagine all of his other interviews I have heard have been softball. You're wonderful. Tell me your story and everything. I think it's a lot more interesting if it pushed back. And unlike this isn't a pro-Israel basis. If Coates gave, if there's an alternative version of Coates coming with a highly pro-Israel book, I would be perfectly pleased if someone gave him exactly the same treatment.
Yeah,
it's more interesting.
But they haven't by and large. I mean, I think that's kind of now changing. In fact, the whole idea of this interviewer getting blowback is kind of a new thing. I mean, the conversation is changing, and that's interesting. But what I would say is that, you know, CBS is a news outlet. I think this show is in the news division. They should have standards for interviewing people and try to treat different people the same in some generic sense. I'm sure you'd agree. And so for starters, I would say having somebody, and the first thing out of your mouth is, this is, you've written a book of an extreme that an extremist would write. That's just name calling. That's just like, you're a Putin apologist, or you're this, you're that. That seems to me like just name calling. And, you know, I'd say the stuff about you left out this and you left out that, it should be fair critique given what the book is, you know, and I think Coates was right to say, look, all, you know, there are tons of Americans who have no idea what life is like for Palestinians on the West Bank. And I'm just telling them, of course, there's a history to it. And of course, the Israelis have their side of the story. And if they told that, then the Palestinians would want to reply to that by saying, well, yeah, but before that atrocity by terrorists, the Israelis did that. And that's always going to be the case. I don't know.
I sort of get that. You can imagine a book, I'm going to tell a certain narrative here. But if you're presenting a moral issue, I think you have to sort of at least honestly present the other side in the course of it. I haven't read the book, and this is kind of, there's subtle issues of making a case for something versus sort of trying to be neutral reporting. And I could get that Coates wants to make a case for something, but it does seem like a fair counterargument. Again, flip it, where somebody's writing about a situation in the Middle East and they entirely take the Israeli side. There's not a single mention of any part. I can imagine you interviewing a person saying, you were only telling half the story.
Well, no, but I mean, if he was telling an historical narrative and only told half of that story, fine. But I don't think he's doing anything in the way of causal explanation for how this came to be. He's just saying, you guys don't understand. And look, I've been to the West Bank. I've been to Hebron where he went. And I'm telling you, Americans have no idea. There is no doubt that apartheid is the right word for what's going on in the West Bank. Now, that's not technically the same as saying Israel's an apartheid state if you don't consider the West Bank part of Israel. The question, you know, I mean, the big reports, Human Rights Watch and Bet, whatever it is, the Israeli human rights group, Bet Shalom or something, or Bet Salam, I think, and Amnesty International, they all came out with reports saying Israel's an apartheid state. And they all meant that to apply not just to the occupied territory, but to Israel proper. That Israel proper is a much subtler. I mean, I'm not ready to apply the word apartheid to what's going on there. But if you think of the West Bank as part of Israel, which it isn't under international law, but which more and more Israelis seem to think it is, it's not even close. This is just flat out apartheid. And you can't go there and come away thinking otherwise. But almost no Americans, I think, really understand that. And I think, you know, for Coates to say, look, here's my mission. You know, it's like if nobody knew how bad life is in American prisons and you just spent time in there and said, this is how hard it is for prisoners. And you didn't quote any guards saying, you know, but you don't understand. You turn your back on these guys. You know, you gotta, we have no alternative but to do rough justice. I mean, would you say, I don't know. I just don't think that's some kind of dereliction of duty. If nobody knows what the situation is like in the first place, and you're the person who helps bring it to people's attention, then the debate can continue. But you know, I don't know.
So it depends what kind of books Coates wrote, this section of the book. If it's this sort of reporting, let me tell you what I have seen, period. Then in some way you could say, oh, I saw something different, or your reporting's boring or something, but there's nothing to argue about. My feeling from the context is Coates is making a moral argument. Somebody makes a moral argument on a contentious issue, you can push back.
Well, you can push back, sure. But his position, and he said this clearly in CBS News, is I just think apartheid is wrong, period. There's no justification. It's like, that's my feeling on torture. It's just wrong. Shouldn't torture. And so if I call attention to torture happening, I don't, given my moral framework, which is just that it's wrong, 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 I don't really feel I have to interview the torturer and say, why did you do this? I'm just trying to call attention to the fact that the torture happened. I think that's a reasonable position. But I mean, anyway, it's like my main thing is I don't think this interviewer interrogates all arguments in similar fashion. By first of all, it's not extremist to say that the West Bank is apartheid. This interviewer should go to the West Bank if he thinks it is. Okay, they can't vote. They don't get due process of law. There's all these roads they're not allowed to drive on. There's places they're not allowed to walk. Plus, I mean, they are just last week, Israel started bombing. They bombed a refugee camp in the West Bank, killed 18 people. Okay, it's not even like cop police brutality. So, what is the claim that's so outlandish that you should be able to, that you should call this guy an extremist right off the bat? I don't understand.
Well, your analysis in some way makes Coates' book uninteresting. You're saying, look, what he's saying is so obvious, you can't argue against it. Who could ever argue against it? So all you'd want to do is, you know, congratulate him on his courage and how wonderful it is to have him on the show and make small talk.
Here's a subtler challenge. I think Coates, unlike me, is saying that what happens inside Israel proper is apartheid. Now, that's a pretty vulnerable claim, if you ask me, because it's true that there are places in Israel proper where if you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel, you're not allowed to buy property. That is a fact. But my understanding is those are very narrow circumstances. And so that would be a subtle, that would be an interesting interrogation. But to say you didn't, when it's not an historical analysis to begin with, I don't know. Anyway, my main problem is with the word extremist at the outset. Like, that's just name calling.
Maybe. I could imagine, though, somebody making that, I always think in terms of the parallel of the sort of flip side of the case, so making a very strong case in favor of Israel and, you know, saying, and that one response being, you have written an extremist book. You've written an extremist book because you haven't taken the moral responsibility to look at the other side and look at the countervailing argument. Mm-hmm. And even if the pro-Israel book made a narrow argument, a narrow moral argument, in some way is like that, I don't know, that Hamas's mass murders, plainly they're mass murders, they killed many people, no doubt about that, and kind of tried to stop there. I could imagine somebody saying, yeah, but if we're going to interrogate the moral issues, we got to go deeper.
But a lot of people do stop there. I mean, actually, I mean, are you saying that all you're asking, so are you saying there is a comparison between what this interviewer did and what an interviewer would be doing if somebody came on and talked about the atrocities of October 7th of last year and the interviewer said, wait a second, how can you possibly not talk about the circumstances of life in Gaza and blah, blah, blah that led up to this?
If somebody was just giving a report of the atrocities, mm-hmm. then fine. It's historical. It's reporting. You could argue pros and cons. Maybe they're even uninterested in the broader
moral
issues.
Morally condemning them the way Coates is condemning what he's condemning. I mean, should the interviewer then say, how can you possibly not talk about why Hamas got to be like this in the first place?
This isn't a gotcha for me because I agree with you. I think in all of these things, you know, particularly if there's meant to be a sweeping moral argument, and if the sweeping moral argument is in the context of justifying Israel's response afterwards, mm-hmm. yeah, of course you interrogate the prior causes.
Okay, well, I would just point out that in that particular context, on mainstream media, that almost never happens. And B, if it does, if you do say that, you run the risk of them saying, oh, you're trying to morally legitimize the atrocities of October 7th.
But this is kind of my point.
In a world where the kind of treatment this interviewer gave him was equally apportioned, and there was always interrogation this vigorous, you know, I guess I'd be more open to it. I'd still be against starting off with name calling. And look, there are tons of forums where I'm totally fine with it. I'm just saying, this, you know, CBS News, I think they think of themselves as like, it's not Joe Rogan, it's not this, it's not that. It's a news show, and they have to be careful to subject all comers to broadly the same kind of treatment. I think that's a legitimate point of view.
Yeah, I've never seen these morning shows. I saw the TV series, The Morning Show, and that's where I get most of my knowledge from it. And it gets quite heated. I think you're right. If this was an exceptional case, if they never treat guests like this, and this was this exceptional case where they did, then I think you have a point. Then you wonder, why was this selected out? Was this a particularly egregious guest? I just think sort of in general, in the absence of knowing what they normally do, it was a fun, interesting thing to watch that did not put Coates at a disadvantage in any way. He responded well.
Yeah,
I think they should go on. Somebody should go on and say, I'm here to promote my book, 100 Brunch Recipes. And we should go and say, brunch is a stupid meal. It should be breakfast or lunch. Mm-hmm. Brunch is a disgrace. Justify brunch.
Yeah. Yeah. No, if you can show me that actually CBS News traditionally treats everybody this way, except the name calling, I'm fine with it. I don't really think they do. And again, it just wasn't a very acute critique. It wasn't, you know, but.
I mean, what do you think? I haven't seen him on The Daily Show and on all these other things, but I would imagine that he is getting this enormously respectful, approving treatment. And I don't know. I find pushback much more interesting.
I think in those venues, it's a topic that welcomes pushback. I'm sure he is. And I just don't know if he's going on the places where he would get pushback. I don't know if he's going on, you know, well, maybe these days the places that would give him pushback don't want him on anyway. Fox News places and wherever else.
He should be interviewed by Barry Weiss.
I was just thinking that. He totally should be. I'll bet he'd be up for it.
Yeah, so?
We should arrange it. So, before terribly long, we have to get them on the edge of their seat.
Yeah.
So I think what we should talk about in overtime after the paywall descends is your recent arrest on charges of lewdness in Toronto, Paul.
I think a lot turns on how one defines lewdness, and I want to get into some detail about that.
Now, Paul wasn't, I made that up.
No, that's just...
Paul would
just
never be arrested for lewdness. He's much more discreet than that.
Speaking of Toronto, by the way, my U of T colleague, Jeff Hinton, has just nabbed himself a Nobel Prize in physics for his work. This is with Hopfield, I think, one or two, but his work on the sort of fundamental dynamics of neural networks that form the basis of these AIs that are ultimately going to kill us all.
Exactly. And he thinks they are. He thinks they make us all.
That's right.
It's a funny
thing.
That's
right.
I mean, yeah, we should in when we get to overtime, before terribly long, we should talk more about that. It's funny. Won it for physics.
I didn't understand that at all.
No, he had no idea. I mean, you know, usually there was another guy who won the Nobel in something else. And I heard the interview this morning. He said, well, yeah, you know, you're on the list, but you think it may never come up. Your name may never come up. Well, Jeff Hinton didn't know he was on any list. He's a computer scientist and he won it in physics.
Michael Lewis, in his wonderful book, The Undoing Project, the relationship between Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, ends the book with Danny waiting by the phone the morning the Nobel Prizes are asked, just waiting to hear if it's going to ring.
Really?
And yeah, it's a great ending. And he waits and he thinks this isn't going to happen. And then I think the last line of the book is the phone rang.
Would you admit, if you were waiting by the phone in that situation, would you admit it to an author or anyone else?
I don't know. See, I wait for the phone anyway at the Nobel Prize. I know I'm a long shot.
I just wait for the phone. I just hope someone will be interested in talking to me. It never happens. I just sit here all day.
I just think for me, it's going to be literature. I mean, small potatoes sometimes has these flourishes.
Oh, totally. In fact, I got a quote. This is just a dynamite. This is just a dynamite opening sentence. I mean, this is so good, Paul. I mean, this, oh, maybe we should put them on the edge of their seats for this little nugget of a literary gem. Now, let's give them this one for free, Paul. It's the, it's an opening line. And I just think, you know, if you don't have a Nobel Prize yet, there should be an investigation. Here's the opening line of your piece. I often think about Mission Impossible Fallout, period. That's the line.
That's it.
The killer. I have a question. Do you really often think about Mission Impossible Fallout?
You know, it's this thing about men thinking about a Roman Empire. I hardly ever think about a Roman Empire, but I often think of Mission Impossible Fallout.
That was a great...
Which by the way, is according to Claude, which rescued me on the spelling, it's Mission : Impossible - Fallout.
Mm.
It's a lot of...
That brings us back to Jeff Hinton. I mean, that was a masterful segue because he's an AI guy. Claude, AI.
Yes.
Oh, and we have some commenters provided us better reason... Oh, you're pronouncing it right now. Did you pronounce it correctly just now?
Claude.
You had been saying cloud.
Now I'm conscious of it.
Like a francophone. Anyway, so we should do this thing where we explain there's a lot more to come, folks, and it gets only better if you can imagine such a thing.
Gets spicier.
And if you are a paid subscriber to either the Non-Zero newsletter or Small Potatoes newsletter, it can be yours. So what are we going to talk about in overtime? I want to talk about Jeff Hinton and AI a little.
I want to briefly respond to some of the commentators' responses to what I said about Amy Wax, more free speech.
Amy Wax, the controversial Penn professor who's, what, been suspended or something?
Been suspended with like half pay or something for saying some putatively racist things.
I want to, you know, I saw the movie The Godfather for the first time. I think I saw it when I was a teenager to drive in while drinking beer. So I think that's the reason this felt like the first time. And I have some thoughts about The Godfather.
Oh, that sounds great. I saw Challengers, by the way. Have you seen it?
Now, what is Challengers? I mean, I don't even know.
Oh, it's a tennis movie built around a romantic triangle.
Ah.
It's a lot of fun.
Okay. And it seems like there was something.
What else? Sam Altman.
My Sam Altman piece, which, by the way, was reprinted in the Washington Post, appeared in the newsletter. And if you read the many comments in the Washington Post piece, you'll find that there are people who don't like Sam Altman. They're very skeptical of AI and big tech. I mean, it was like amazing, kind of, almost.
Yeah.
A lot of that.
You have a few things to say about Sam Altman, basically summing up that he would become, if he, quoting, I forget the person, quoting somebody who said that if he was to be land on an island of cannibals, he would become king of the cannibals soon. And you went with that. That was
I went with that. That was my lead. And once you've read that, you just can't stop reading, wouldn't you say?
It's not the kind of lead like about my Mission Impossible thing, but it's very...
No, that's a much better lead. I often think of, what is it? I often...
Mission: Impossible.
That is some good shit, man.
Okay. People are going to wonder what it's up to. And we don't need to talk about it. But the point is, I argue that Ethan Hunt, the action hero of it, is not a utilitarian.
Yeah.
And the whole movie turns around a point where he saves his friend and potentially condemns millions of people to die because of it. And what that means.
So we'll get into that. We'll get into because if you thought that great opening line was all there is to that piece, folks, are you ever wrong? And we'll do other, we'll just riff and be our zany selves. So, but should we promote anything? Like your Twitter handle is Paul Bloom at Yale. Mine is Robert Reiter. Although both of us found that these days in the Musk era, Twitter, matter. You cannot doesn't, increase your number of followers. It's like matter. There's a ceiling. It's a glass ceiling.
My followers have not increased. My tweets get no pickups. It's
some of my tweets do. You have to put a little Ta-Nehisi tweet. You know, like a little critique of certain Israeli policies. I find does the trick. But not always. So, we will see folks on the other side. Thanks for listening and watching. Hope you'll follow us into overtime.
See you on the other side.